From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our foreign policy contributor puts President Trump's state visit to the UK into a historical context.
Then, robots have been displacing human workers for a long time, but more recently, the dynamic has been changing.
The new thing is that robots are becoming increasingly cheaper and increasingly smarter, and that's changing everything.
Are Milwaukeeans endangered by herbicides and pesticides in public parks? Our Beats Me segment examines the issue.
And with a commemorative statue set to be unveiled this weekend, we learn about the pro wrestler and South Milwaukee native known as the Crusher.
If the nationalization of wrestling would have occurred earlier, or if the Crusher somehow could have prolonged his career, you know, he was like Hulk Hogan before Hulk Hogan.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. President Donald Trump is in Great Britain this week in advance of commemorations for the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion in World War II. The president is no stranger to political controversy in this country, but he visits the UK at a time of significant political turmoil.
But these are not entirely unprecedented times in which we live. Art Sear is our foreign policy contributor and joins us to share some historical perspective on President Trump's visit and also to examine the state of politics in the UK as Prime Minister Theresa May's time in office comes to a rapid conclusion. Nice to see you, Art.
Well, thank you, Mitch. A pleasure to be here.
As we're having this conversation, the President of the United States, President Trump, is making a state visit to the UK at a really tumultuous time for politics in that country. But we were talking before we turned on the microphone just a little bit about the reception that the president gets in various places. And I want to turn the clock back about 50 years here to Lyndon Johnson, who was he was president at a sort of similarly tumultuous time. And you were kind of sharing the days when the president was really challenged to speak anywhere in this country.
Yes, indeed. Well, President Johnson was a very different sort of president and personality, but thanks to the Vietnam War and some other things, but especially Vietnam, which literally tore our country apart in the 60s and continued to resonate long thereafter. I was making the point that during President Johnson's last year in office, the only place he could or would speak, the Secret Service was quite adamant publicly, was on military bases around the United States. And the dynamic is very different today in all kinds of ways. President Trump, for all the media attention and controversy, and his extreme rhetoric and extreme reactions to him were certainly not in that period. Lyndon Johnson, I believe strongly, will also go down as a very consequential president concerning especially the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, Medicare, Head Start, and other programs directed at the poorer sectors in society.
But by 1968, those things were sort of in the background while Vietnam.
Everything was overcome by Vietnam. And the president, that president, colorful as he always was earlier toward the end, said quite regularly as the war began to consume everything else, the Great Society, this tremendous social and economic reform program that he got through Congress, is the dimension of my work, to put it that way, that I love, but this war is dragging me down, and the war has me around the neck and won't let go. It really was a tragic presidency in many ways, but he was fortunate, tragically, in the sense that between the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas on November 22, 1963, and the big escalation of the war in 65, going into 66, during that time, the president was able to move a tremendous amount of legislation through Congress, a lot of it very durable. He also dominated the Senate in the 1950s to a remarkable degree. His style and temperament and personality could be so off-putting that his tremendous gifts as a politician in that era are too easily overlooked. Robert Caro, C-A-R-O, whose serious work has been discussed on public radio quite appropriately, his multi-volume biography of President Johnson is really worth time and attention.
Well, and move forward 5 or 6 years, and similarly towards the end of the Nixon presidency, there were fewer and fewer places in this country where he was comfortable speaking as well, in really a circumstance of his own devising.
Yeah, also a tragic end to a presidency. Both leaders were crucially involved in bringing themselves down. But I do think President Johnson was more a victim of circumstances. I think Kennedy probably would have maneuvered us out of Vietnam. He was simply too smart to get trapped. But President Johnson was trapped overall by the fact that he was supposed to be fulfilling the legacy of his martyred predecessor. And it was almost impossible, I think, for him, despite his legislative strengths, to resist the tremendous pressure from the military, but also what we call the military-industrial complex, and public opinion generally to escalate in Vietnam. With Nixon, it's more Shakespearean. He's more directly involved in destroying himself politically, in my view. As I tell our students, you can't have your own facts, you can't have your own opinions, and on these complex subjects, it's really important for each of us to develop our own point of view. I'm just giving you mine.
Well, okay, so let's return to the present then, and President Trump's visit to the UK. What does he see in what is the opportunity for him? Why is it important for him to be there at this time? Obviously, we're coming up on the anniversary of D-Day.
Yes, and that really cemented the Anglo-American alliance. It's always tough to run any alliance. Winston Churchill famously liked to say the only thing worse than trying to collaborate with allies is not having any allies at all. The British, from before the beginning of World War II in Europe, were working assiduously to create a strong relationship with the U.S. King George VI and the Queen visited Washington, I believe, in 1939. Just before Germany invaded Poland. It was orchestrated by the British government through their representatives in Canada, a very shrewd decision early on to get together with our former rivals and enemies, the Americans. And after Churchill became first Sea Lord, Secretary of the Navy, and then Prime Minister after the fall of France, it became a priority. And they would market him like a product in the U.S. When you read especially the diaries of that period, but lots of good histories, these very sophisticated men and women in the British government who were not provincial people, they would come back from the States saying, it's unbelievable what these Americans have. It's truly unbelievable. Working people, we're still in the Depression, working people have automobiles. They have motor cars. They can afford their own radios. They have, you know, single dwellings. It's just extraordinary what they have. Their resources are endless. And if we're going to eventually win in this conflict with the Third Reich, we've got to get them on our side. Farsightedness, that's something we Americans don't do very well. And the British continue to survive through all kinds of difficulties, I think partly because they do that characteristically. That's the nature of really good diplomacy.
Well, and so the British government is at a pivotal point right now with Theresa May stepping down, having fallen victim to an ongoing saga over Brexit. What does the UK get out of a presidential visit at this point in time, if anything?
Well, our current president is kind of the American stereotype that they love to hate. He seems to me to personify an image of the ugly American that is quite widespread around the world. And at some level, it's almost enjoyable to read about or listen to parliamentary debates where earlier on after his election, there were intense statements about banning him from the United Kingdom, and they go on and on and on. So in that sense, he's useful, not just to people on the left.
In the sense that we might have it bad here, but here's somebody we think of as worse?
Yeah, although ironically, if the British do leave the European Union, the shorthand term for that is Brexit.
Yeah.
I think it'll be an opportunity which both sides will probably take advantage of to reinforce already important ties with the Americans, especially, again, in the field of defense, national security, bilateral military cooperation, and especially intelligence, where I believe historically they do better than we do. But in any case, that was the true beginning of the special relationship. And that's important news to follow that won't be in the headlines generally.
There are a number of polls that show increasing support in the UK for Brexit without any plan in place. And I guess what do you read into the sentiment that says we're just going to leave the European Union, consequences be damned?
I think that would be very disruptive, especially for lower income, the usual people who get hurt by big economic dislocations, again, working people, not only in Britain but also on the continent. I think they will work it out. I hope that they will have another referendum. The Conservatives under the last Prime Minister, David Cameron, outsmarted themselves by having a referendum, which they didn't have to have in 2016, which led to a very narrow majority in favor of leaving. I don't think the average Brit really wants to leave without any kind of agreement at all, because common sense does ultimately define that culture more than some others. I think they'll probably have a referendum.
Who do you see filling the power vacuum left by Theresa May?
Well, there is no power vacuum. She has been a remarkably ineffective and frustrated prime minister. She was in favor formally of remaining in the EU before the referendum. And then she called a snap election, which she didn't have to call. They thought they would reinforce their narrow majority. They had quite ruthlessly gotten rid of their coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats. Instead, they lost and are now dependent on an extremely ideological, right-wing, rigid small party from Northern Ireland. It's been a series of missteps, which is not just 2020 hindsight. Why did they have to do this? I think they will emphasize stability above all. I think the Conservatives could still continue in power, but I believe a coalition is much more likely, which makes it too bad Cameron was so unnecessarily brutal toward the Liberal Democrats, although it's a rough system. He was being typically British in the way he treated them.
So I guess let me ask you, and this is maybe unfair as a last question, but this is the last time the two of us will chat on this show together. And, you know, we talk about the state of the union. Let's talk about the state of the world in the middle of 2019. You know, we talk about the tenuous place that British politics are in. As the two of us wrap up this conversation, it's hard to find a place in the world where things aren't on the precipice of something different.
Rapid change is going on. You're right. And a lot of that rapid change is all to the good. Something like 300 million people, that's million, not thousand, Chinese have gone out of poverty. I mean, real abject day-to-day survival poverty, which is totally alien to American life today, even our poor people, into something that we would consider a reasonable lifestyle in the last quarter of a century, since the great leader Deng Xiaoping declared people's socialism. And what's happening in China, to a greater or lesser degree, is happening around the world. Africa is now a special presence, is now highlighted on the remarkably friendly World Bank website, I must say. Africa as a magnet for foreign investment of all kinds, and not just by China, by private capital, especially from all over the world, especially this country. And it's not the usual infrastructure, not the usual mining and basic infrastructure projects. All kinds of construction and investment is going on. Women are rising dramatically in political participation, literally all around the world, including in Africa and South Asia and Islamic countries. And that's a guarantor of more law-abiding government, of decline in population growth, all the good things in life. So I would say there's a lot that's very positive, and the really hateful and devastating ideologies of the 20th century, Nazism, fascism, communism, they faded. There's only a couple outposts left in the world. So to me, it's very positive. I realize that's not a popular point of view, and that's not the way a lot of American young people see the world today, because I have the privilege of dealing with them regularly.
Is the friction now not so much between haves and haves and not have-nots, but haves and have-mores?
I think, yes, that's quite right. I do think it's unhealthy that in this country, especially, income differentials since about 1970 have grown dramatically from the beginning of the New Deal. Through the 1960s, we had a reversal of that trend. It's become much more like the 1920s. That's politically destructive as well as, from my point of view, immoral. It's a recipe for political conflict. But working people in the states today are far better off than working people in the 1920s. It's easy to do. Take a look at what Ford Motor Company workers were living on and how they were living before the autocratic and brilliant and very difficult Henry Ford took charge of worker lifestyles and started building cars that they could afford. He took a lot of grief from other automakers, but he would tell them regularly, fellas, we want our workers not only to be healthy enough to be productive, but we want them to be able to buy our damn cars. If workers aren't making them, eventually we'll go down. And we're not in that revolutionary situation today. Again, that's my opinion. We'll see.
Art Sear, it has been a pleasure talking with you over the past 13 years, and to be continued.
Well, thank you for all you've done. Yes, indeed. I look forward to talking to you from your new home, I hope.
Lake Effect contributor Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business, and he directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. You can listen to our past conversations with him at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then a journalist looks into the rapid pace of change in the field of automation and how American workers can prepare for a future that might see their jobs become obsolete. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. As the manufacturing sector has evolved and job numbers have fallen, the rise of automation has been a key part of the equation. But technology is impacting more than just assembly line jobs in the 21st century.
If your job was suddenly replaced or changed by a robot, would you be ready? That's the question that journalist Andres Oppenheimer asks in a new book. It's called The Robots Are Coming: The Future of Jobs in the Age of Automation.
Oppenheimer is a columnist for the Miami Herald and a host on CNN Español. He told WUWM innovation reporter Chuck Quernbach that robots have been making their way into the workforce for a long time. But Oppenheimer says he wanted to write the book because the pace of change is increasing.
The reason is that while we've had robots in factories for 5-6 decades, there's something very new. And the new thing is that robots are becoming increasingly cheaper and increasingly smarter. And that's changing everything. Why? Why are they becoming cheaper? Well, because China is buying robots as if there were no tomorrow. They've become the world's biggest buyer of industrial robots. And they're becoming smarter because until 10 years ago, a robot was an individual machine. No, you had a robot, you put a chip in its head, and it would perform some mechanic duty 10,000 times a day in a factory. But today, robots are linked to the cloud.
And of course, the cloud you speak of is a computing cloud, if you will, and in some ways another robot.
Yes, they're connected to the computing cloud, you know, and through that, they're connected to every other robot in their network. And that makes them incredibly smarter than just an individual robot that has been, you know, coded, instructed to perform a specific task. So that changes everything. We are living in a new world, and robots are going to be part of our life, much more so than until now, and they're going to threaten many of our jobs.
And you've reached out to quite a few people, traveled a few places to reach these conclusions. Is that right? Talk a little bit about with whom you spoke.
Well, I started doing my research like 6 years ago when I read a study by Oxford University saying that 47% of our jobs were at risk of disappearing over the next 15 years. And I said, wow, that sounds a little bit exaggerated. 47, almost half of our jobs will disappear within the next 10, 15 years. Sounds like a lot. But then I started looking at my own life, at my own profession, as a journalist with the Miami Herald, with CNN Español. And I said, wow, it's already happening all around me. Until 5 years ago, I taped my show with 5 cameramen, camera people. How many do I have today? 0. All my cameras today are robotic. I get instructions from some floor director who I don't know where he or she is, and they tell me to look at camera 1 or camera 2 or camera 3. At the newspaper, I used to have a translator. I used to, you know, I wrote my columns. I have a syndicated column, so I write my column for the Miami Herald in English. I used to send it to a translator. she would translate it and send it to me back by email. I would edit it, and the whole process of editing her translation would take me, 20 minutes. But a year ago, the automatic translations by Google Translate and other algorithms became so much better that the newspaper is using, you know, Google Translate and other algorithms to translate instead of human translators. So that same thing is happening with lawyers, with bankers, with physicians, with all kinds of professions and occupations. So what I did, after I realized that this was a serious thing that was happening all around us, is interview the top gurus in the biggest professions and occupations and ask them what is going to happen over the next 5-10 years.
And let me take one of those, if I may, the doctors. What's going to change for the medical profession? Don't we always need someone looking in our mouth and prodding and poking us and so on?
Well, doctors are going to be hit as much as journalists and as much as bankers and as much as many other professionals. Because let me give you an example. A dermatologist. What does a dermatologist do nowadays? He takes your arm, he looks at your sunspots, and he says, okay, this one is good, this one is bad, this one is good, this one is bad. If it's bad, he takes a biopsy or he orders one, and you have to treat it. If it's good, he says, you know, you're fine, go home. But now you have a telephone application whereby you can use your cell phone to take a picture of your sunspot, and the app will tell you immediately whether it's good or bad. If it's good, you go on with your day. If it's bad, you go to the doctor and treat it. So 50% or so of the work that a dermatologist does nowadays is going to disappear overnight, because we're all going to do that with our cell phones. The same thing goes for radiologists. If you're a radiologist and you look at x-rays, a smart machine, a smart computer, can detect much more than a human doctor today. Now, that doesn't mean that doctors are going to lose their jobs, that we're going to have much fewer doctors than we have today. No, we're still going to have doctors. The doctor will continue doing a lot of things that only humans can do. Things related to empathy, communication, they're going to translate to us what the smart machines say. They're going to hold our arm and tell us, don't freak out. You know, this is not so terrible. What the computer is telling us is this and that, but we can do such and such. So there's going to be a doctor around, but he or she will not do what they're doing today. They're going to do something very different.
I'm wondering if there's any sort of regional or international variation in this potential job loss. I am looking at a recent story in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that said 1 in 4 Wisconsin jobs are at high risk in the new age of robotic workers and hyper-automation. How do things look across the states or countries? Is there some variation?
Yes. The states that are most dependent on industries, on manufacturing, are going to be more hard hit than the states or countries that are highly dependent on most services or other industries. Why? Because the easiest thing a robot can do is a job that's mechanic, repetitive, predictable. And remember, robots work 24 hours a day. They don't take vacations. They don't ask for a raise. They don't unionize.
So is it partly a call for more vocational training, retraining at the technical colleges and so on?
It's many things. The first thing you need to do is to find out what's going to happen with your particular field of work. If you're a journalist, you have to reinvent yourself into either an investigative reporter, an opinion writer, a humor writer, many other things that a robot is not able to do as well as a human. But writing just a plain fact-based story, that's over. That's going to be done and is already being done by a computer. And the same with lawyers, with economists, with bankers, with teachers. Teaching is another example. If you're a teacher and you spend most of your time transmitting knowledge, telling kids who invented the printing press or in what year Columbus discovered America, you better start preparing for a change because that's going to be over pretty soon. It doesn't make absolutely any sense for teachers to be purveyors of knowledge when any child can go to Google and find out who discovered America in a much more fun way, you know, with music, with videos, with all kinds of visual effects. So teachers are not going to disappear. We're still going to have teachers, but they're going to do something completely different to what they're doing now. They're going to be mostly professionals who are going to be mentors, who are going to be helping kids discover their passion, who are going to teach kids to work in teams, who are going to convey ethical values, all these things that a human can still do better than a machine.
What jobs might be pretty much unaffected? Anything in particular stand out, or is everything going to change a bit?
Well, at the end of the book, I have a chapter entitled The 10 Jobs of the Future. Actually, there are 10 areas of the jobs of the future. Many of them are pretty wide. And the first one, of course, is anything related to health. Anything related to health services has a very bright future for the simple reason that people are living longer, the population is growing, and when you have people, you know, living 80, 90 years, even 100 years, as many are now living in Japan, you'll need more health services. And that goes from doctors and nurses to psychologists to nutritionists to Zumba instructors. And then I go down the list. There are many other professions that have a bright future. And unlike many of the technology gurus I interviewed in Silicon Valley, in Japan, in Israel, in Korea, and many other places I visited to write this book, I do think that there is a future for the humanities. I do think that there is a future for artists. I do think that there is a future for writers, for screenwriters, for designers, for everything related to the arts, for a very simple reason. People will have increasingly more free time. Many of us think that we are working like crazy, but in fact, we are working fewer hours than our ancestors when they were farmers and worked 18 hours a day. And we have increasingly more holidays, and we have a Saturday and a Sunday, which is something relatively new in the history of mankind. And we're spending much more time watching Netflix and TV series than we did in the past. And that requires, you know, actors, writers, musicians, all kinds of artistic skills.
So you offer a sort of a balanced view. Let me ask, though, about some of the human assistance robots don't work all that well, do they? Autonomous vehicles seem to have a way to go. Do we have too much confidence that these robots are really going to replace humans in some cases?
Robots are not ready yet to do many of the tasks that humans do. But I have zero question in my mind that they're going to do that very, very, very soon. And that all these things we're reading about are going to happen much sooner than most people think. You talked about cars, about self-driven cars. Well, I've ridden in several of them, and I already see them on the road as test vehicles, of course. But I have no doubt that we'll see them in a matter of 2-3 years. Look, things are happening all the time, but we have become sort of numb. Our capacity of surprise has sort of disappeared. If you think that only 12 years ago we didn't have smart cell phones, it seems unbelievable that only 12 years ago we would drive without a GPS in our cell phone, or we wouldn't have all the apps we use today. That's all very new. And what is 10, 12 years in the history of mankind? Nothing. So these things are happening already much faster than many of us realize. And I have no doubt, look, I'm currently working on a story about a flying car. Several companies, including Uber, are testing flying cars, and some of them are hoping to have them on the air. So I don't know whether it's going to be next year. It may be, you know, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. But it's not going to be 30 years from now. These things are happening, and we have to prepare ourselves, because most of us are going to be affected. I don't think everybody's going to lose their job. I don't think many people are going to lose their jobs, but many of us are going to lose parts of our jobs, and we have to start preparing ourselves to reinvent ourselves.
What about if technology invents new processes that actually need more workers? I mean, 125 years ago, who knew we'd need thousands of auto workers, for example?
I'm not painting an apocalyptic scenario here. My book does not sort of propose, you know, that we sink into a deep depression or anything like that. No. In the long term, technology always creates more jobs than it eliminates. It has always been like that, and I think it's going to continue being like that. But what I'm worried about, and what many of the people, of the gurus I interviewed, are worried about, is the short term. Because the times to reinvent ourselves are getting increasingly shorter. In the Stone Ages, we had thousands of years to reinvent ourselves, from hunters to farmers. And then we had another couple of thousands of years to reinvent ourselves, from farmers into industrial workers. And then a couple of decades to reinvent ourselves again, from industrial workers into service workers, professionals. But today, the pace of automation is so fast that many people won't have, you know, centuries or years or perhaps even months to reinvent themselves. Take somebody who's working as a cashier at a parking lot. That person is being told that she's going to be replaced by an automatic cashier overnight. That person is going to have a hard time reinventing herself or himself into a data analyst in 24 hours. So in the short term, we're going to have a huge problem, and I say in the book that this is going to be the biggest problem of the 21st century for all of us, and we have to prepare ourselves individually and as a nation.
Andreas Oppenheimer is the author of The Robots Are Coming, The Future of Change in the Age of Automation. He spoke with WUWM's innovation reporter, Chuck Kornbach.
Are the pest and weed management products used in Milwaukee's public green spaces a threat to people who use them? Our Beats Me segment investigates that question when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. As summer approaches slowly this year, the area's green spaces are increasingly filled with people picnicking, playing frisbee, or just basking in the sun. Maybe you're one of them.
But one of our listeners wondered about public green spaces and whether chemicals that manage pests and invasive plants pose a threat to people. She asked WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz to investigate as part of our Beats Me series.
Susan's story begins at Milwaukee County's Juneau Park, just north of downtown.
Juneau Park's 15 acres hug the bluff above Lake Michigan. The park features two imposing statues and a lush canopy of trees. Its Friends Group planted and cares for a small but profuse pollinator garden. I asked John Canavan how often Milwaukee County Parks crews apply pesticides or herbicides here.
We really don't treat anything.
Canavan points to Juneau's sea of dandelions as Exhibit A.
The only pesticide they'd be using is a little bit of Roundup in the weed beds and around a few of the light poles, stuff like that. As far as like a broadcast herbicide, fertilizer, we don't use them in open spaces like this.
And if you're a dog park person, Canavan says not to worry.
I know people are sensitive to their dogs, and I understand, so we just kind of let it be.
Canavan says the park system has tamped down chemical applications in recent years. He says there's more than one reason. The first, they're expensive.
You know, as budgets tighten, we've just used less and less. And then, you know, now people are thinking about the green spaces. You know, honeybees do love clover and they love dandelions. It's a great food source for them. So we don't treat those areas anymore.
Canavan adds when park workers do targeted pesticide applications, those areas are properly marked.
What we do is if we do treat an area, you'll see the flags up saying 24-hour notice following the law of Wisconsin.
Canavan says you're most likely to see those flags in Milwaukee County Park's natural areas, in parks such as Falk and Bender. They're managed by Brian Russert.
2017, we used 15 gallons herbicide to manage 10,000 acres.
So it's very laser specific.
Over his 10-plus year tenure, Russert says his team has built a comprehensive management program.
We have an internal reference guide for each invasive species we manage. We've done the research looking at what are the most effective chemicals for them, what are the amounts to be used for active ingredient, and we also look at the phenology, because these invasive species are vulnerable at a certain time of year and your treatments are most effective.
Russert says the plan is paying off.
We're doing inventories of our plant species, invasive and our rare natives, and our wildlife to see how those populations change over time. But I've definitely seen those areas that were filled with aggressive invasive species 11 years ago, the woodlands are coming back to life. The spring ephemerals are showing up again. The migratory birds and the species using these sites is increasing. So it's showing a very positive trend at areas that we are managing.
Russert says pesticides and herbicides help protect wildlife habitat by keeping invasive species at bay. Yet he says he continues to learn, including from mistakes. About 2.5 years ago, his team applied an herbicide to drive down invasives on a 2-acre area within Ware Nature Center in Franklin. 300 trees unexpectedly died.
So Ware Nature Center, unfortunate situation there, and we're working to mitigate that. We've changed where we use the herbicide just to be safe.
Russert says the tree loss did have an unexpected silver lining. A native plant called small flowered leafcup popped up, and the federally endangered rusty-patched bumblebee is appearing on the park's landscape. UW Extension weed scientist Mark Renz thinks it's important for residents to realize that every management choice Milwaukee County or any park system makes comes with pluses and minuses.
How do we manage them appropriately that's acceptable to the community? So do we use herbicides or do we not use herbicides? Do we get heavy equipment in? Do we not? Do we burn? I mean, there's positive and negative aspects with all of those.
Renz says he's looking for ways to better educate the public to the importance of strategically controlling invasive plants, not only for people's enjoyment of green space, but also the greater health of the ecosystems we share. Our Beats Me listener isn't the only person worried about the use of pesticides and herbicides. UW-Madison plant pathologist Paul Koch says he understands the concerns. He says while products are rigorously tested for safety for years before going to market, people and their pets should still stay away from freshly applied chemicals.
And that's why you have to keep those little signs up and keep, you try and keep people off of those treated areas for 1 to 2 days after the treatment so it can dry in the plant, absorb into the plant.
Koch says when properly applied, that includes not before a significant rainstorm or when temperatures soar into the 90s. The pesticides are designed to break down in a relatively short amount of time. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
You can read more about this story or submit your own questions to our beat reporters at wuwm.com/beatsme.
Coming up next, the Crusher statue in South Milwaukee will memorialize a pro wrestling legend. A look at his career and the early days of pro wrestling when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. You may know the beer that made Milwaukee famous, but how about the man? Reggie DeCrusher Lasowski was a pro wrestler from South Milwaukee whose career spanned the 1950s through the 1980s. His tagline, the man who made Milwaukee famous, was a nod to his character, which was pure Milwaukee.
DeCrusher was a blue-collar, beer-drinking man who ate Polish sausage and came on stage to polka music. This persona is part of what endeared him to Chris Smith, a South Milwaukee native and the organizer of a project that sought to build a statue in honor of Crusher.
Much to Smith's surprise, the project quickly reached its fundraising goal, and the statue is set to be unveiled in downtown South Milwaukee this Saturday. Smith sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers earlier this year to talk about DeCrusher's career and the early days of pro wrestling.
The thing about DeCrusher was he reached his height of popularity and peaked just like all people do, wrestlers, celebrities, whatever. And he was winding down at the end of his career, just as wrestling kind of got into the mainstream in the 80s with Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant and all those guys. And Crusher, wrestled a little bit for the WWF right at the end of his career, part-time. But if the nationalization of wrestling would have occurred earlier, or if the Crusher somehow could have prolonged his career. You know, he was like Hulk Hogan before Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan actually learned from him. They came up in the same company, which was called the AWA, and it was based out of Minneapolis. And so they wrestled all over the place. Crusher wrestled all over the planet, but primarily it was a Midwest territory. And so that's why he's still very popular among the baby boomer generation, especially Milwaukee, because no matter where he wrestled, he was announced, you know, the man that made Milwaukee famous. And so he reached a pretty significant, at least in the Midwest and especially in Wisconsin, I mean, you could definitely consider him a celebrity at the time.
So he was the PBR of wrestlers.
Absolutely. I mean, he's very, just very Milwaukee.
As someone who is not so familiar with, you know, the history of WWE, the history of wrestling, professional wrestling more generally mm-hmm. in the U.S., what was it like in the 1960s, 1970s, compared to what we might think of more in the 80s and even now?
It's an interesting history. I mean, you go back to the 50s and wrestling was covered like any sport is now. In the newspapers, and people followed it like it was a legitimate sporting competition. Now we know, and most suspected, or maybe in the 50s, not most, but some suspected, that it was scripted, okay? And it still is. But, you know, wrestlers to this day do not appreciate anyone, you know, claiming that it's fake because the pain is real, and these are, and Crusher was a terrific athlete. His tag team partner, Dick the Bruiser, played for the Packers. So, I mean, they're real athletes. It's absolutely real. But, you know, the endings are and probably always were scripted. So back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, this was what they call the territorial days. And you had Vince McMahon Sr. in the Northeast, based in New York City. And you had someone called Vern Gagne, who was based out of Minneapolis, and he ran the AWA. And then you had the Mid-South, and you had the Houston wrestling. You had a bunch of territories, and they were very territorial, and they respected each other's territories. And the AWA, which covered the Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, was very successful. A lot of the wrestlers that the younger generations have heard about, it wouldn't be unusual for them to come through the AWA, like Hulk Hogan, Big John Studd, Bobby the Brain Heenan, Mean Gene Okerlund. They all came through the AWA. And so what ended up happening in the 80s, Vince McMahon Sr., who ran what was first called the WWWF, but then they shortened it to just the WWF, he sold the company to his son, Vince McMahon Jr., and Vince McMahon Jr. did something that no one ever did and that really the other promoters didn't like. He basically bought airtime in every territory. Just long story short, nationalized wrestling. And it was a success. The other territories fought him, but he was making enough money that he could lure the big stars like Hulk Hogan from the AWA. And then it just, in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, it got extremely popular. They teamed up with MTV, did something called Rockin' Wrestling, and at the time, very popular celebrities got involved, like Mr. T and Cyndi Lauper. And so it just kind of took off, and the territories kind of died. And so Crusher was absolutely one of the most popular wrestlers in the territories. And unfortunately, when Vince McMahon Jr. kind of took over, he did bring Crusher on, but it was a very part-time basis because he was just older and he just was at the end of his career at that point.
You mentioned, you know, in the 1950s, it was regarded as this kind of, you know, very real sport. Mm-hmm. But there is that scripted element of it now and in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the personas are a big part of that and a big part of what really made the Crusher mm-hmm. who he was. Can you give us some, you know, he was the Milwaukee guy. Can you give us some examples of how that manifested in his character?
Absolutely. I mean, your character, you know, and wrestlers now call it your gimmick, okay? Mm-hmm. You have to have something that gets the crowd interested in you. You know, wrestler's worst nightmare is you're out there, you're getting announced, and they don't, the crowd does nothing. They want you either booing or they want you cheering, okay? Either one is good. You know, so over the decades, wrestlers come up with a character. Andre the Giant was the big, mean, nasty giant. You know, before that, he was a good guy, too. But, you know, you had cowboys. You had a guy from Canada who called himself Rowdy Roddy Piper, who was wore a kilt and acted like he was from Scotland. And you had people in masks. And you had people who were like, you know, voodoo priests. You had Native American characters, you know. So Crusher's character, if you will, I don't know how much different it was from who he was as a person, because it was, he would come out to polka music. He would call himself the man that made Milwaukee famous. He would do interviews and talk about, you know, back in Milwaukee, he won the crown of Mr. Saloon 10 years in a row, and that's because he could eat the most Polish sausage and drink the most beer and throw the drunks out of the saloon and do the polka. And very famously, he would say his workout consisted of running along the shores of Lake Michigan with a keg of beer on his shoulder. And when his workout was over, the keg was empty. You know, so that was his character, and it was probably very much inspired by who he really was, because he grew up in South Milwaukee, went to South Milwaukee High School. He raised a family there, and I work in that town. I work for the city, and if I had a dollar for every Crusher story I've heard from people there, I'd have a lot more money than I do now.
You know, you mentioned the beer barrel running mm-hmm. around with the beer barrel, and he himself is was a very barrel-chested yeah. kind of guy, not exactly who you would look at and say, oh, that man's a wrestler.
Yeah, he, you know, he didn't have the physique of like a bodybuilder like some wrestlers do, especially in the 80s, a lot of them did. But he was built, and he was thick, and he was strong. And in this process here of creating this statue, I've worked closely with the Crusher's daughters, which has been very much a joy for me. And Crusher measured all his measurements, his biceps, his chest, and they kept that. And so the statue is actually going to mirror that. And he was a big, stout guy. Now, his physique changed as he got older a little bit, but he was always a big, strong man.
For someone who was able to have a very long career, considering what his career was, you have to imagine he was very fit.
Right. And before he could wrestle full time and before he started wrestling, he, you know, was a blue collar worker. He was a bricklayer. He had a bunch of jobs that were all very physical. And then he became successful enough wrestling that he could do that full time.
So you mentioned you've been working with his daughters mm-hmm. to get this statue built. You know, what is that process like actually getting, I mean, first of all, getting the place to put the statue, getting, I'm assuming there's permits involved with that, mm-hmm. and then getting really the momentum in the community to get this thing built and building it.
Well, you know, going back to raising the money, I mean, I talked to a number of different places that could create the statue, and pretty much my target was $40,000. And honestly, I anticipated this being something that would kind of just mirror my career. I'm 40. I just turned 40. And I thought, over the next 20, 25 years, you know, I'll try to do this. And then hopefully, by the time I retire, I'll have enough money that I can kick in whatever we need and then get this thing done. And, you know, it just goes to show that still, you know, I mean, we're 14 years after his death. He died in 2005. How much people still love him. I launched the website in very late December, after Christmas, 2017, and we were fully funded by March. So 3 months, basically. And we actually got more donations than we even thought we needed. And so then the process of actually creating the statue, we picked a very reputable firm in Milwaukee called Vanguard Sculpture Services. The owner actually went to South Milwaukee High School, knew the Crusher's daughters, so it was kind of very cool. And I've had a lot of people in the city come up to me and say, oh, you're so popular for doing this. Because it's a very, I mean, in 2019, 2018, pretty much it doesn't seem like people can agree on anything. But social media, you got to really search for a negative comment about the Crusher statue, okay? We're not asking for public money. It was all privately funded, and pretty much the response has been super positive. And so I've had people come up to me and say, well, you're very popular in South Milwaukee right now because you're behind this. And I would always reply to them, yeah, but if the statue turns out and looks like crap, my name will be mud. But very recently we have seen, and the Crusher's daughters and myself have seen, the final clay sculpture, and we gave it the green light to go forward to make the mold, to get, you know, whatever this process is, to have it made out of bronze. And I am no longer worried about my name being mud over this, at least, because it looks wonderful.
So it's going to be erected pretty soon, right?
Yeah, June 8th.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What are your plans moving forward for the statue?
It's very close. I mean, we're within a couple months probably of it being finished. And then June 8th is the date that we picked for the unveiling. There's a spot for it in the city, kind of right in the heart of the city. South Milwaukee does have like a natural downtown, and their main street is called Milwaukee Avenue, and it's right 11th in Milwaukee. And so once the snow melts, if that ever happens, we have a bunch of companies that have agreed to donate labor and materials to turn the little parcel that the city has dedicated to where the statue will go. They're going to turn it into like a miniature park. The local bricklayers union, a big landscaping company called KEI Landscaping, and a company called Miller Monuments, they're all coming together, totally volunteer, and they're going to turn this little parcel, which right now is part of a parking lot, into a park. And it's going to be a brick plaza. And the part where the statue is going to go is going to be in the middle of a 20 by 20 brick square, which is the same dimensions of a wrestling ring. So it's going to be a very, I think, cool little spot for the statue to call home.
Chris Smith is the organizer of the Crusher statue, which will be unveiled this Saturday as part of Crusher Fest in South Milwaukee. Smith spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers earlier this year. There's more information about the project at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.